Good afternoon. My name is Pete Nanov, and I am a student supervisor at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the University of Maine and Dickinson College, it is my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's panel discussion, The Pros and Cons of Public Service. Our panelists are Admiral Gregory G. Johnson, Judge John E. Jones III, and Hollister Knowlton Petraeus. The panel will be moderated by Daniel D. Churchill. Admiral Gregory Johnson assumed duties as commander of U.S. naval forces in Europe and commander-in-chief of Allied forces in Southern Europe in 2001. He retired from active duty in 2004. He graduated from the University of Maine in 1968 with a bachelor's degree in political science. In 1969, he was commissioned following Aviation Officer Candidate School and designated a naval aviator in 1970. John E. Jones III is the U.S. District Judge for the Middle District of Pennsylvania. He was appointed United States District Judge in 2002. In 2005, he presided over the landmark case of Kitzmiller v. Dover School District, in which he held it unconstitutional to teach intelligent design within a public school science curriculum. A 1977 Dickinson College graduate, Jones also earned a law degree from the Pennsylvania State University Dickinson School of Law. Hollister Knowlton Petraeus, a 1974 summa cum laude graduate of Dickinson College, is the director of BBB Military Line, a program of the BBB Center, an educational foundation associated with the Council of Better Business Bureaus, Incorporated. She's the wife of General David H. Petraeus, the commander of the United States Central Command. Daniel D. Churchill is chairman of the Board of Advisors of the School Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine. His last post, from which he retired, was Vice President of Finances of Avis Europe PLC. He earned a bachelor's degree in engineering and physics from the University of Maine in 1963 and his master's degree with high honors from Boston University in 1972. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. And now please join me in welcoming our panelists.
We are obviously a panel of alumni, which gives a slightly different slant than the previous panels. And as Peter has explained, we'll be focusing on the pros and cons of public service. Hopefully not too many of those have already been touched on, though I fear a fair share have. So we will have 3.5 talks, I guess. Mine will be a short one at the end. Please hold your comments and questions until the end. Grob?
Thank you for the introduction. It's an honor and privilege to be here to be amongst such a distinguished group of public servants. Pretty humbling for a little old potato farmer from northern Maine. And I want to, before I begin, thank everybody who had anything to do with putting this together. I don't think that there really is a more timely topic than this whole issue of public service. I think we're at a important point in our history. I think the American public is very receptive to this, and at least in the circles that I travel, there is an immense amount of work going on in this particular area, and I think great expectations that we are going to, maybe this happens once every 50 years. Someone mentioned earlier this morning, one of our speakers, about the great sense of public duty that was inculcated into us with the election of President Kennedy in November of 1960 and when he took office in 1961. It's been almost 50 years, and I think we certainly need to be recharged in this area. We have come from the Cold War industrial age to a post-Cold War, and who knows exactly where that's going to go, very much the 21st century and very much an information age, and they're profoundly different. And the organizations of our government and the way we develop policy and, quite frankly, execute it are very much based on those Cold War models, and I would submit to you that they aren't as relevant as they used to be. In fact, they're quite harmful, possibly, if we're going to be successful for the kinds of challenges we face in the 21st century. Before I begin, though, I would like to recognize President Durden and President Kennedy. Thank you for not only giving your support for this, but your support in the sense that you participated and and were with us all day. That means a lot. And Harry, to you and Bauman, thank you and your staffs for really pulling this together. And I can't imagine that you, the caliber and the quality of the participants here today. And when I say participants, I mean not only the people who spoke to us. We had some powerful speakers by some of our nation's absolutely finest, most selfless public servants. But when I say participants, I mean all of you who are sitting here in this audience who have taken the time to join us here today and to think about this profoundly important issue. I also want to thank Dan and Betty Churchill. As a University of Maine graduate, as is Dan, I've certainly heard about the Churchills over the years, but quite frankly, until last evening at dinner, was the first time that I'd had the opportunity, the distinct pleasure of meeting them. And so thank you very much in what you did to bring us together here today. Now, the topic we were supposed to talk about this afternoon is the pros and cons of public duty. Well, I guess when you own the microphone, you can talk about just about anything you want. And it's not fair to take the subject you were given and change it into something else. But I'll put up a couple of disclaimers up front. From my personal view, I don't think there's a downside to public service. So when it comes to the cons of public service, I find it hard to imagine that there are any. And I really don't see it that way. Now, I would agree with one of our questioners this afternoon, or this morning, I believe, that talked about the fact that there are different times when you can come to the realm of public service. It doesn't have to be through college or and then take a job in the government and decide to make a career out of it, and like I did, or like Ambassador Burns did, and then continue in various other ways after you retire in your second life to support these kinds of endeavors. There's certainly ways where you can go off into the private sector, come in as a political appointee, or go off in the public private sector, and then come back in any number of ways. So I'm not saying that public service just has to follow this one model. But I do believe that everybody has an obligation for public service, and that what we're really talking about today, and I think what needs to be done, and there are many ways that we can do it, but we need to inculcate in people, into our society, a profound sense of duty and obligation to serve some higher purpose than ourselves. And I remember, you know, how did I ever come to public service? Well, I grew up in a tiny little town in northern Maine that had about 40 people, and I had two things driven into my head from the day that I can remember things. And that was about the time when I can remember that there was one thing important in life, and that was the Boston Red Sox. And that was about the time I could start remembering these things that my parents were trying to inculcate in me. And there were two things. One is that you will have an education. You're going to go to college. And, you know, they were second-generation immigrants growing up and farming. And they didn't go to college, so they were determined that all their children would go to college. And the second thing is that you can't live in a community and reap the benefits of that community unless you pour yourself back into that community. So I realize this was a small little town, but my dad was a selectman. My mother was the town treasurer, and she wrote us, my brother and I, our check every week for $1.50. We got 30 cents a day for being the janitors at our little one-room schoolhouse. And then there was the church, and you had to be on the council. You know, when we were younger, she was part of the youth organization. We were a rural area. We had 4-H clubs, so she was a 4-H club leader. Back then, public health was in its very nascent stages, and they had, I don't know if they even have them anymore, but I remember distinctly having all these suppers and pies and things to raise money for the health council. And part of that was to get fluoride treatment for your teeth. And because we weren't on public water systems. So as country bumpkins, we had to go, they'd truck us into Caribou to the dentist and give us fluoride treatments. And these people worked long and hard to raise money for this. And so I remember distinctly and my mother saying, well, you cannot have the benefits of fluoride treatments to your teeth or going to church or being a member of the 4-H club or whatever it was, or being a member of our little town, if you didn't do something, if you didn't become part of some organization that helped it work, help it function for the greater good of the community. And so I figured out very early on that I didn't want to be a farmer. And so my goal in life, and I guess Mr. Comey isn't here, but my goal in life was to become a lawyer and to become a prosecutor. And so I worked very hard in that. I was fascinated by political science, by history. I was a political science major in college, and I wanted to go to law school. And we do have funny ways that we come into our life's journey. And so those, how many of you are students here today? Raise your hands. And you probably all have some idea of what it is you want to do and what you're aspiring to. And I bet that there's a certain number of you, but I think it's less than 50% of you who just raised your hands, are going to end up doing what you think you're going to be doing now. And then when the time comes, there will be twists and turns that you never, ever anticipated, but that you will have a fine education. You will have learned how to learn and to listen and to have an inquisitive and inquiring mind. And whatever opportunity unfolds in front of you, you will be able to grasp it, seize it, and take advantage of it. Well, that moment for me happened during Easter break of my senior year. And there was a, speaking of public servants, there was a public servant in the United States at that time. His name was General Lewis Hershey. And he ran an organization called the Selective Service. And he had been running that organization. This was 1968. He had been running that organization since July of 1941. And he was pretty good at it. And he sure found my number. And I didn't go to law school. I went off to something called Aviation Officer Canada School. I wasn't in ROTC. I didn't go to the Naval Academy. I had no idea that this is what I would do. And when the time came to leave the Navy after your what we call minimum obligated service, instead of doing that, I stayed in the Navy and spent 36 years there. And it was absolutely the most satisfying and rewarding thing that could have ever happened. And I had no idea, even at Easter break of my senior year when I was still in denial, that this is something I was going to spend the rest of my life doing. So I don't know what curves and paths you'll end up taking, but be ready, and some of you are going to be surprised. But whatever it is, I hope that part of it, sometime in your life experience, professional experience, includes some form of public service, because I can assure you with absolute certainty that there is nothing more gratifying or rewarding, and the people that you work with, and the, a little bit of what Deputy Attorney General Comey was talking about, the sense of satisfaction, the sense of accomplishment when you come home at the end of the day after some challenging tasks, you're going to I think feel it is the wisest decision that you could have ever made. Now, I don't know why we've had difficulty in that. Right now in our society, using a military example, we have about 1.5 million people wearing uniform. And we have 300 million people in our country. And if you do the math on that, that's about half of 1% of our population wearing uniforms right now. That's the lowest number of people in uniform in our country since the since before World War II, the interwar years, when we had a very, very small military. Only 1.5 million people. I mean, 1.5 million. That doesn't count reserve and National Guard, so there are more than that. But active duty people, and that transfers into the number of people in Congress, the leadership elites in our various communities and what have you, that have experience in this side of the public service sector. And I think it's very much the same. We had a huge hiring bathtub in the late 80s and all through the 90s, and you heard Dr. Kennedy and others talk about the demographics of our public servant population, 1.8, 1.9 million people. In the next 5 years, we're going to have to replace one-third of them. And so that turns out to be about 100,000 plus people a year we're going to have to hire. If we're going to try to replace them. And I think we're all learning what's happening over the last year, that the size of government probably isn't going to get smaller, at least in the foreseeable future. So we are going to indeed have to replace these people. And you're doing it with a huge difference in experience. You're going to have to replace 600,000 people who have had 20, 30, 40 years of experience with new people. and life is getting much more complex, and people talked about that. Contracting is one big one, and we've paid some severe consequences for that. We'll be working that through the U.S. Attorney's Office and other ways for a long time, regrettably, and if we'd had more talent in that particular area, we probably wouldn't have had those kinds of problems. To carry this point home, let me just bear with me. I want to read you a quote. One Saturday morning, a year and a half ago, October 20th, because I know the date on the article, I did my usual thing. I was home. I tend to be home on the weekends, back from Washington, D.C. or whatever, and my wife has a few chickens and a donkey and a pony, and so my job on Saturdays is to go into town with a pickup truck and get some hay and feed and all that kind of stuff that she needs. And so I went into town, and as always the case, stopped at the – this seems kind of incongruous, someone in a pickup truck going to get hay – but stop at the Starbucks and get some coffee. And but pick up the copy of the New York Times, because that's where you can get it. In Brunswick, Maine, you can get it at the Starbucks. And I always go to the op-ed page and look at what's there. And that particular day, there was an article by a young man named Will Bardenwerper. And the title of the op-ed that he had written for the New York Times was "Party Here, Sacrifice Over There." And I looked at that and I started reading it. And it, just bear with me. In January of 2006, I stepped off a C-130 in Tel Afar, Iraq. As I began my 13-month deployment, I imagined an American public following our progress with the same concern as my family and friends. But since returning home, I have seen that America has changed the channel. Young investment bankers spend their impressive bonuses on clubs in Manhattan, and many seem uninterested in the soldiers fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. As a Princeton graduate and former financial analyst, I was once part of this world, and I liked returning to it, putting the Spartan life of Tel Afar and Anbar province behind me. But even as I enjoy time with the friends who have welcomed me home, my thoughts wander back to other friends who continue to fight as the city parties on. Serious problems with the war in Iraq are well chronicled, but I am struck by one that does not seem to trouble this country's leadership, even though it is profoundly corrosive to our common good. The disparity between the lives of the few who are fighting and being killed and the many who have been asked to do nothing more than to continue shopping. And I don't think that that's the America that we want, or that those youngsters who are wearing the cloth of our nation necessarily deserve. And so I am heartened by the fact, this particular op-ed, I carry it with me everywhere, and every time I get the chance to pontificate, which is what retired admirals like to do, I try to find a way to incorporate that thought into what I have to say. And I carry it with me everywhere. I think this young man, Captain Retired, or Captain who did his time in our United States Army so eloquently, talked about. Now, he went on to say and was proposing maybe we ought to consider the draft. I won't use the word draft, but I think we ought to consider some type of national service, and we've had a lot of people talk about that. In the realm that I deal in, which has more to do with national security, though, I'd like to just give you some examples to, I think, affirm the fact that there is an incredible tide, a momentum of effort going forward in this area. And I really do think, as I was talking with Ambassador Burns just before his comments, we are at a hinge point in our country where we maybe it's time to get that 50-year renewal and to be re-inspired for a sense of public duty and public service. In November of 2007, every year in the fall, there's the Alf Landon Lecture at Kansas State University. And in November of 2007, that lecture was given by a fairly new Secretary of Defense, Secretary Gates. And he spent that entire speech talking about the reasons why we needed to increase the budget of the State Department. He didn't talk about the defense budget or defense issues. He talked about why we needed to increase the budget of the State Department. Subsequent to that, he's given any number of speeches on the same topic. He's testified before the Foreign Relations Committees with Secretary Rice. and he continues along this line. I could not agree with him more. My experience, which was in Bosnia, Herzegovina with S4 and Kosovo with K4, and only tangentially at the beginning of our efforts in Afghanistan and Iraq, is that, yes, we need the military. We need a kinetic part of national policy. You will always need that, and they need to work together, the power with the more nuanced and diplomatic side. And you can't have one without the other. But the end game is always going to come from the non-kinetic, from the soft power, from the smart power, whatever it is you want to call it, and the ability to disengage U.S. forces, if our country makes a decision to engage them, comes when you have enough governance capacity, security capacity, not from military but from police. And you have the ability of hoping that you have a self-sustaining government that in some fashion can maintain stability and operate in a sustaining fashion, and then you can withdraw U.S. forces. And otherwise, you're trapped. You have the wrong implement, but you don't have another implement to use. And we don't have that much capacity now. As you heard someone talk about USAID from the height of Vietnam, 13 to 15,000 people, down to about 2,000 people who administer contracts. And the U.S. Information Agency, we're certainly losing the battle of minds, hearts and minds, and it's been essentially disbanded, and it's in certain nooks and crannies of the State Department, but we are not doing that very, very well. Where's our friend from Woodrow Wilson School? Ah, there. Were you there when Admiral Mullen was there 2 weeks ago? So you heard Admiral Mullen speak, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is picking up on Secretary Gates' theme, and he was talking about the militarization of U.S. foreign policy. And what he was talking about, the same thing. I've got to go find farmers from Texas and Kansas and what have you that are National Guard units that can go to Iraq and help me with this agricultural problem. You got an agrarian society, all about poppies. What are we going to do? But the Department of Agriculture doesn't have a social contract with its people, doesn't have excess capacity to send people over and help me. Or how do I build electrical capacity, civils, infrastructure, rule of law institutions? Where's all the people from the Justice Department that are going to teach us or teach police and teach them about forensics and rules of evidence and a penal system and a court system and what have you? And these are the kinds of things I think we're going to need. We certainly need now, and we knew this from Bosnia, we knew this from Kosovo, we knew this from Haiti, we knew this from a lot of our experiences, yet we seem to have to relearn this lesson. It's a lesson that we identify every time, but we never learn it. We just identify it. And so let's hope that we learn it. And what this means is that we need a lot of human capital to do these kinds of things. And I think that we're at a point where we have a chance to do something. There are any number of efforts that are going on. One that I'm personally involved in, National Security Advisory Council, which is a offshoot of the U.S. Global Leadership campaign, which came out of the Smart Power Study commissioned by CSIS and led by Professor Joe Nye and Dick Armitage, which addresses this issue. There's the Project on National Security Reform, which was commissioned by Congress. Among the people who served on that is Admiral Blair, who I think those of you at Dickinson know, a colleague of mine from the Navy. My former boss when I retired, Jim Jones, who's now the National Security Advisor, was on this. Michelle Flournoy, who is now the Undersecretary for Policy in the Defense Department, and our just designated a designee to be Deputy Secretary of State, Jim Steinberg, was also on that study group, along with many others. But it's looking even at a larger area of just reorganizing our entire government from its 20th century Cold War industrial age mechanisms into something that's more germane to the 21st century information age that we're in. So I think with all of this happening, I think we're at a time in public service area where I think that there is enough momentum, and the issue now is, do we have the wisdom, do we have the courage, do we have the leadership that can take advantage of this moment in history, which I think could change us maybe for the next 50 years, to infuse this sense of public duty in everybody? I think that these young students that are out here today are the best and brightest that America has, and they ache to serve. And we just need to challenge them and find the mechanisms to help them do that in constructive and positive ways, and we need to think about how we're going to organize that and do that. And I would tell you that I can only say that from my perspective, in terms of public duty, that it is all positive. And there are things that are frustrating about serving in the public sector. We had a question today about how hard it is to even try to get a job. And you do have to put up with some frustrations. They are large bureaucracies, and they're a bit ponderous at times. And I would just ask you that you have to go into that with an open mind and understand that. But one individual over time can make a difference, and don't be frustrated because they're large and fairly slow-moving bureaucracies. But it is so important, and I think that the youth of today are every much as committed as we were in our time or any succeeding generation, and they just need to be focused, and we need to find the mechanisms to help them serve. And so I would commend you on this conference, and I think that if you should seek a life in public service or some window of your life in public service, I don't think that you can possibly find something more rewarding or stimulating. So thank you all very much.
I wish you all a pleasant good afternoon. I've had some interesting experiences in my life. This is the first time I followed an admiral on the program. This is such an honor for me and such a distinguished group. I had the privilege of seeing the ambassadors, some of the ambassadors' remarks this morning, unfortunately not all of them, and I also saw the Attorney General's remarks, and suffice it to say that this is a formidable group and an auspicious occasion. I want to thank the respective presidents, President Kennedy and President Durden, for putting on this symposium, and my old friend Harry Pullman, who hooked me into this, and I'm Harry's utility infielder, and I show up every now and again at different events at Dickinson, and it is truly, as I said, an honor and a pleasure to be here. Just a couple of brief remarks, because I want to hear what our other panelists have to say and what's on your mind. One thing that strikes me, and I'm sure that it occurs to you, how fortunate it is that we're having this day, this event to talk about public service here in 2009. Can you imagine if we'd had this 4 or 5 years ago? It'd be a big so what, wouldn't it? Well, gee, we're all going to Wall Street. We're going to do credit swaps. We're going to learn how to make millions and millions of dollars. How times change, even a year ago, a year and a half ago. So this is so timely and so topical. And so necessary in this day and age. I am the proud product of a liberal arts education at this wonderful college. I have proclaimed that widely and loudly, particularly over the last couple of years. Now, I will tell you that unlike the Attorney General, I was not a chemistry geek. I was a political science major who about 30 years later, found himself in a maelstrom over science that captured the world's attention. And that, of course, was the intelligent design case. Happily for me, when I came back several years ago and gave the commencement address here, I ran into my old geology professor Noel Potter, now retired, and Noel was much more thrilled to see me than he had been at any time that when I was in his class. And he looked at me, he was very emotional. He looked at me and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, it was at a reception they had for me the day before, and he said, "We just knew you could do it. We knew you had it in you." I said, "No, you didn't." I said, "No, you didn't." But it, some of it shows, as you consider public service, I think, the essential goodness and value of a broad-based liberal arts education. So perhaps in some way I'm a commercial for that. When you think about public service, and I was struck by what several of our speakers, the Admiral said and what the Ambassador said, I do trace my desire to go back to go into public service back to President John F. Kennedy, believe it or not. And I was quite young, but I remember him vividly in his time in the aftermath of the Kennedy administration. And I suspect that there are a lot of us who feel the same way. I didn't come from a family of public servants particularly. I think that some family members thought, to the extent that I got into politics and public service, I had a defective gene when I began to do that. But I find that people who get into public service and who are reasonably good at it will tell you that through some mechanism, through some trigger, they were called to it. They were called to it. And so it is in my life that I felt the need to get in first to state government and then to serve as a federal judge thereafter. There are all kinds, as you've heard today and you will hear more of, there are all kinds of ways that you can serve the public. But at any level, those who succeed and who do the best jobs, I think, will tell you that they have a high degree of job satisfaction, satisfaction. I was struck by the Attorney General's statement that essentially, if you have honor only without that essential satisfaction, then it's a pretty empty vessel. All of the accolades, all the honorary degrees, all the various honors that you can accumulate in your time in public service will never make up for a job that is not personally and professionally fulfilling to you. There is also a sense, I believe, that, and it is maybe quintessential American idealism, that you can make a difference in what you do, no matter what level you find yourself, or as you rise up through levels, you can make a greater difference as time goes along. And isn't that sort of an American ideal? And I don't mean that as a conceit, but it is something that I have found in the best public servants. They don't consider that sort of shop-worn phrase, make a difference, to be that at all. They really do believe that they are working for the public good. It's always interesting to me that, I've been around on the bench now long enough that I've accumulated a sort of alumni association of former law clerks. And almost to a person, these clerks, who uniformly are in the top 10% of their law school classes and who go out and find jobs in the most prestigious firms in the United States, I'm happy to tell you that they start out in those firms making more than I do when they leave. But more and more, they come back and they say to me, you know, my 2 years with you, my 2 years as a law clerk for a federal judge, not that I'm that great shakes, but working for a federal judge, they were the best professional years of my life. And it sets you to wonder, when that salary spread is something between $50,000 or $55,000 as a judicial law clerk and perhaps $150,000 to $200,000 in a Wall Street law firm, there's something to that. And more we see these clerks moving to the large firms, spending a couple years at those firms, and then transitioning back and going into the public sector and pursuing these jobs, which I think is wonderful to see. I was asked to consider the pros and cons. Obviously, that's what this panel is about. And my initial reaction on the negative side, the con side, was I couldn't think of a lot of negatives. But then I got to reflecting about it. And in the world that I operate, I have to see people who go off the rails and violate the law, and that from time to time I have to sentence. Some of them, sadly, come out of the public sector. If you work in public service, and if you each day wallow in self-pity because you think that you're not making enough money at your job, or in the worst case, if you develop some sense of entitlement, that you think that because you are a person who is not being paid appropriately for the work that you do, if you do that, you're going to develop a sense of entitlement that is a drag on public service. You either won't do your job well in that instance, or in the worst case, you're going to break the law, and you're going to end up in a far worse position, and you're going to discredit the organization that you work for. So it truly is a sacrifice, but it's not, it ought not be, a debilitating sacrifice. And if you have that pull to public service, and if you have that job satisfaction, then you shouldn't lapse into that self-pity or that sense of entitlement that is the worst possible thing for someone in the public service. When I gave the commencement address at this college several years ago, in one of the very greatest days of my life, I counseled the graduates that year to follow what the philosopher Joseph Campbell said, which was to follow their bliss. And I didn't mean by that, obviously, the old 60s saying, if it feels good, do it. I meant that they should do that which is most fulfilling and makes them happy. And so it is if you feel pulled into public service. And I really commend anybody who chooses that path. It is so necessary, as the Admiral said, in today's world, for us to think more and more about public service. And maybe we have a renaissance that is taking place and a different view of public service than perhaps, as I said at the outset, we had several years ago. I believe that a good liberal arts education prepares you best for a career in public service. It's not the only path, obviously, but that is a bias, perhaps, that I hold. As I look at the program for this event, I note under Dickinson College it says that it was a revolutionary education designed for a revolutionary age, and that harkens back, obviously, to Dr. Rush and the inception of this college, but it really applies today, doesn't it? A revolutionary education designed for a revolutionary age, because, folks, we are in tough times, but I think out of tough times come wonderful, innovative things. We are producing leaders today in these institutions, both the University of Maine and Dickinson, who will systematically pull us out of the dire straits that we find ourselves. This is a revolutionary age, perhaps a wrenching age as well, but it's public service and public servants working for the public good who will ultimately prevail. So I appreciate deeply the opportunity to spend some time with you this afternoon, and again, I'm honored to join my fellow panelists here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have to say this is kind of an unenviable position to be batting cleanup for speakers like we've had today, so you'll have to forgive me if I belabor any points that you've already heard. There was one oversight today, though, so I thought I would just have to tell you, you really can't talk about government service and not have a set of PowerPoint slides. So, you know, they don't call us PowerPoint Rangers for nothing. So, and we also have that phrase, death by PowerPoint, which I will try not to inflict upon you, but I did feel like it was appropriate. So I just did a few slides to go with my presentation. A little bit about my history. I am a Dickinson grad. I was delighted to be invited back. I have to say, it only took me 35 years, but finally I get to see the inside of the president's house. So I feel like I've really arrived now. I know for you students out there, you probably think we 70s vintage Dickinson grads probably you know, are practically from the horse and buggy era and tea dances and such. But I'll just tell you that in our day, the quads were where all the fraternities lived. And if you've seen the movie Animal House, that kind of would give you a sense of what it was like. You can ask the judge more about that later.
I'm not saying that. Statute of limitations.
Sure, background investigation done.
And I was a true liberal arts major. I majored, double major, French and English. Not that I planned to teach. It was just what I liked to study, and I felt it, you know, it has served me well over the years. I also am an Army daughter and wife. I think most of you probably know who my husband is. He's fairly well known. it's kind of amazing, really, the public profile he's had. What you may not know is that my father is also an Army four-star general, and so at a very different era, because when I was here in college, it was during Vietnam, so a different time in our military, but I've definitely seen that life through the lens of a daughter and a wife. After marrying, I was a Department of the Army civilian for 6 years, then had kids, and spent 20 years volunteering. The Army's not dumb. They know they have a big pool of untapped talent out there in those military spouses, and a lot of their family programs, they run largely with volunteers, and I was one of those. And for the last 4 years, I've actually been running a program for the Better Business Bureau system to educate, do consumer education for military families, and I've really enjoyed that. It's kind of like my midlife crisis in a good way to try something new. So that just tells you a little bit about kind of my credentials, if you will. And obviously, when I talk about government service, it has to be through the lens of the military, because that's really been largely my experience. And again, public service, just for the purposes of this talk, really will mean government service. And I'm addressing this pretty much to those students out there. And I'll do three sets of pros and cons for you. So there's your first, the con. You won't get rich. There's just no getting around it. Of course, as we've pointed out, right now you won't get rich on Wall Street either. So, you know, somebody who's actually hiring, like the U.S. government, might be looking a lot more attractive right now than they used to. Going back to the not getting rich part, just for fun, I went into my files and I looked up what my husband and I were earning as we both embarked on our government service. And as a second lieutenant, he was making the princely sum of $9,000 per year. And that was gross pay, not take-home pay. And I was supplementing that with my really excellent GS-3 government salary of $7,600 per year. So we lived in style, a trip to Bonanza Steakhouse at least once a month. but, you know, we managed, we got by, and we're certainly doing better at this stage in our lives financially, but and you can be comfortable in government service, but you will not be rich. But that leads me to the pro, which is you may not be rich, but you get to do a job that's about more than amassing a pile of money and material possessions. And I do think that resonates with this generation. I know that many people have heard the message that they've gotten from the new president. Many college students are considering nonprofit work, I know. My daughter graduated from Dickinson in 2004, by the way, and a lot of her generation is out there wanting to serve. But I'd like you to remember that you can serve others by working for your government as well, and that's what I want to talk about. As I told you, my dad was a career Army officer, all the way from World War II through Vietnam up to 1980. And he went to a very posh prep school in Massachusetts, and many of his classmates went on to become very wealthy captains of industry and banking. But he noticed at their reunions, when he went back in later years, many of them, at the sort of twilight of their careers, were really questioning the value of how they had spent their lives, chasing the almighty dollar. So they made a ton of money, so what? Was that all there was? And my dad never had that feeling. He spent his life wearing the uniform of his country. He skipped the opportunity to be rich, to play a part in historic events, and he always felt that he had served a cause greater than himself. Every military officer swears an oath when they're commissioned to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And they know that they are contributing in some small way to the preservation of what I think is the greatest form of government on earth. And civil servants serve that larger cause as well. So I really think that's something to consider when you realize that you will not be wealthy in government service. Now, another con. You may have to move a lot, and it's really hard to find somebody who'll put up with that. And that one particularly applies to the military. I've been married 34 years, and we have moved 21 times. In the days before telecommuting, that made it practically impossible for a spouse to follow a career path other than a volunteer one. You remember those 20 years of volunteer service on my resume? Well, that's partly why, because there weren't many jobs that would move that many times. Jobs are a little bit more portable now in the computer age. In fact, I'm a telecommuter myself now. This four-year job I've had with the Better Business Bureau, I've moved three times. They're great. They just give me a laptop and say, keep going. So that's been wonderful. So, you know, jobs are a possibility, but you still have to find a spouse in the first place. And I will say, especially for our soldiers right now, that's been particularly hard when their jobs have them deployed half the time and training or moving the other half. You know, it's tough to say, hey, want to go out? I have email. I'll be gone for about 12 months, but, you know, you can email me. So, that's difficult. I mean, there's just no getting around it. And the only thing I can offer is that I don't believe that this pace of deployment will continue indefinitely. So definitely a con that has to be thought about. And one, frankly, that I know is something that does drive some folks out of military service. They just, their families will only put up with so much. But now we go to the pro, which is you do get to see the world. And if you have kids, they'll be very resilient. I told you I moved 21 times in 34 years, and I also moved as a kid. Remember, my dad was in the Army, so my grand total, lifetime total, is probably about 30 times moving. But I've gotten to do neat things. I was born in Paris, France. I've traveled through the Sahara Desert, been to Libya, which I don't think a whole lot of people in this room can say at this point, ridden a camel in Bahrain, learned the word for chicken pox in Germany. Yes, both my kids had chicken pox while we were there. And had many, many other adventures. So if you join the Foreign Service or the military, that could be you. And I love the life, frankly. I like knowing there's something new around the corner all the time. So yes, it's a con, but it can also be a pro. And for me, largely, it's been a pro. And when you do have kids, you know, sometimes I bristle a little at military families being portrayed all the time now as victims. Oh, those poor families, it's so difficult. You know, I think military kids actually are very resilient, and they have a very large worldview because they have moved so much and walked into so many new situations. And I think a lot of college administrators will tell you that the military kids who come through their doors as students have the least difficulty in adapting when they come to college. They're resilient because of the lives they've led. So don't let the family side of things, you know, put you off entirely, because there's a lot about this life that really is something to enjoy. It's a lot of it's partly your attitude. So, one more con for you. Government jobs are not always fun, meaningful, or exciting. I know there was a young lady who asked a question earlier and mentioned a friend of hers who went to work for the government and wasn't getting to do stuff that was important or exciting enough, and so quit. You do have to realize at the entry level, you are not going to be the one striding through the halls of the Pentagon crafting the new defense policy. You know? It just doesn't work that way, at least not for a few years. You have to gain something called experience first. And experience is not always exciting. And I will go back to that six-year civil service career I told you about when I was in my 20s. Because I moved so often, I had to take some available jobs, shall we say. And there were some that were really, really not very interesting. One was clerk typist in a high school completion program. In another, I was a clerk assigning government quarters to military personnel. I was a test proctor. Stop. Put down your pencil. Do not turn the page. Dental clinic safety officer. Had to listen to those drills all day, which was a little traumatizing. And yes, also, I was a machine operator. When my brother heard that, he said, "My God, now you're doing factory work." I was like, no, actually, I wasn't. I was in something called G3 training aids, where back in the days before computers, when people wanted slides, they had to be done on these huge machines that stank of ammonia and stuff. And anyway, yes, that was one of my jobs, too. And a lot of my jobs involved being the dreaded cubicle dweller, which I know a lot of you don't want to do. My daughter sneers and curls her lip whenever she talks about, "I'm not going to spend my life in a cubicle." And I had to tell you, in those days, usually you were in a cubicle in an office full of people who chain smoked, which was really not a great experience. And no, it wasn't exciting. The jobs weren't exciting, but they were useful. They were useful in gaining experience. For me, by being a very small cog in the machinery of a big army installation, I learned a lot about how it worked from the ground up and all the moving parts. And I gained experience that stood me in good stead further down the line. And it's also not like I was chained to one job forever. There were always other openings and opportunities for promotion. And the same certainly applies in the military. You will only stay in a job for a year or two before you are reassigned to something different. It's all part of that gaining experience again. So realize, even if the job you're in is not that one where you're, you know, at President Obama's elbow and advising him on economic stimulus, it's still gaining you experience, and you're learning lessons that can be useful to you farther down the line. So that, going from the con, I'll go to the pro, which is government jobs can be fun, exciting, and above all, meaningful. And we really, my husband and I certainly have borne that out. My husband got to do some really fun things, even as a young officer, going on adventure training in Sardinia and the Salisbury Plain in England, parachuting from a balloon in the park in Edinburgh, Scotland, climbing glaciers in Alaska. And obviously, today's deployments have moments of high excitement. But you have to realize that it can be very exhilarating to live life as intensely as our soldiers do overseas. And they miss it when they come back, as strange as that may sound. Soldiers form an extraordinary bond with the men and women who serve with them in combat, and for many, it's the most significant time of their lives. Just ask a veteran, like the ones from my dad's World War II unit, who still continue to meet every year, even though they're close to 90 now. I think the great majority of combat veterans would tell you that what they did was very meaningful, and I know that my husband would as well. But I don't want to limit that to military personnel either. Spouses who serve in a volunteer capacity also feel that they are contributing something important. I know I did. We may individually be little tiny cogs in the great engine that drives this country forward, but our individual contributions are part of a greater whole. We can and do make a difference to our country's future by what we do in its service. I'm going to leave you just with a few final thoughts. I found some quotes that I liked, so I'll stick them up there. One from Albert Schweitzer about happiness being in those who have sought and found how to serve. And Arnold Schwarzenegger said it too. The highest honor comes from serving people and your country. And then one last quote, followed current scholarship methods and got it off the internet. So I won't vouch for the translation. It's Plato. But I really liked it, and I think it's food for thought for you students out there as well. Those who are too smart to engage in government are punished by being governed by those who are dumber. Thank you very much.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much. Those were three outstanding talks, and I'm by very significant speakers. I would like to begin on behalf of both Betty and myself by thanking President Durden and President Kennedy for this conference, and as well as the many people in the in these two institutions who brought this into being. Certainly Bahman Bakhtiari, and very especially Harry Pullman and all the members of the Clark Center who've really worked hard to make this happen, both these very competent students, remarkable students, and the outstanding members of the staff. You've done something of real value in setting up this and holding this remarkable conference, so filled with outstanding public servants and with a very important message. Each of the members of this panel comes to you with a long, distinguished public service career. I do not come from a comparable public service career. As you can see, I'm clearly a technophobe. There we go. Right. My public service career consisted of 8 years in the intelligence community, in the CIA and the Air Force, followed by 26 years of also interesting but very different career in international finance, which included 5 years in Belgium and 15 years in London. Since Betty and retirement, Betty and I have had a chance by linking up with these two outstanding schools once again to feel a sense of doing something meaningful, something that one, as we've said, can certainly feel in public service but often eluded us while I was in the private sector. I would like first to mention the pros and cons. You'll note that though it says pros and cons, I'm really only listing pros. Like several of the previous speakers, I find it difficult to enumerate many cons, and those I have, I'll cover as we go through them. As Holly has just said, and several others have, you won't get rich from the compensation. There are areas, however, in which the government compensation is competitive. And, for example, those who have chosen to study environmental sciences or any of a number of areas that our society, for some reason, does not value as well as it should, and this is more of a societal problem than a government pay problem, the government pay scales are actually quite competitive in a number of those areas. There's a young marine biologist we know who has moved from various places she'd worked for 10 years to government and found the government compensation very good and very rewarding. As we've mentioned, fascinating and exciting work, not always, but you certainly, it's really the best opportunity I know to really experience both fascinating and exciting work. And thirdly, great responsibility in an early age. I really know of no better place than government to find such opportunities early in your career, including managing very large and important contracts, influencing or leading important programs, and especially in the military, extraordinary leadership opportunities. And now I've listed fourth, obtaining marketable experience and skills early. I have to bring this up since I've moved on after my public service to the private sector. And if one should find that one does not wish to stay in the government, and for many of us, the career may not suit us, this is an important issue. I mentioned encountering great responsibility at an early age, and that is certainly one of the things that becomes most marketable. Also, often excellent educational opportunities. In my case, I would mention that my years in government afforded me French language training, a chance to live abroad and learn German, building familiarity with other cultures, learning important skills that were not available to one studying the rather narrow area of science and technology in college, and also obtaining graduate degrees in business. But most importantly, and finally, as has been said several times before, doing something meaningful is what it's really all about. This is the fundamental reason that anyone should consider in going into public service. I should at this point stress a con, because there clearly are some. Budgets for programs rise and fall. Changes of administrations can have major consequences. People can find that programs that they went in to serve, to develop, are no longer given the emphasis that after a few years that were there when they began. But for many, these opportunities to make meaningful contributions only grow as one advances in public service. Also, they often continue and expand even after one leaves a government career. As an example, many government employees have gone into one of the think tanks after a fairly long career in government, the many think tanks that line Massachusetts Ave in the District of Columbia. Some find their way subsequently back into government in the next change of administration, and where they may have greater opportunities than ever before. Retired ambassadors and others sometimes devote their lives to forming and running organizations, promoting peace, cooperation, or understanding in some part of the world, or to public speaking. In short, one might just be able to leave a lasting impact on our world. What could be a better reward at the end of a career? When many of us entered, at least in my case, it was during the Kennedy years, and many of us were inspired by Kennedy's words, "Think not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country." We've lost that. We certainly did for a number of years, as bureaucrats were often ridiculed. But, as has been said often, many, perhaps most people in government are working longer hours than they might in the private sector, and in a sector where they could often triple their salary. This appears to be a particularly important time for one to consider going into government. The problems facing the current administration are probably the most wide-ranging, the most all-encompassing in my lifetime. And many of these challenges will be with us for a very long time. Keep in mind some of the problems facing us today. In addition to foreign policy and the economy, we have serious questions regarding the integrity of some in government. Note the Blagojevich scandal. We have to deal with political decisions sometimes being driven by not what is good for the country, but some group which has strong lobbying interests. The current situation is a crisis for a number of reasons, and a crisis, as has often been said, is a terrible thing to waste. I repeat, this may be the most important and most opportune time in a generation for one to consider for one who's talented, energetic, and idealistic to choose a career in public service. Thank you very much. Now open it up to any questions.
I have one. Can you hear this?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. We're saying over and over again that people who work in good government or in community service don't make as much as people who pursue the private sector. But when you factor in the pension program, if you stick it out for enough years, it's actually pretty fair. I mean, my parents were teachers their whole careers, 35 years, and I'm now helping them manage their finances. And even with what's going on with the markets, they're still drawing a nice benefit from that pension. And I understand federal employees have the same kind of a benefit. If you worked out the math, it's the equivalent of somebody having set aside several million dollars that's really not vulnerable to the vagaries of the market, sitting there at work for them, providing their annual cash flow. In fact, it's indexed to inflation, so it also goes up with inflation. Most people who make these high salaries in private sector end up finding a way to spend most of them. So by the time they get to the end of their career, unless they've remembered to save a substantial amount of money, they don't actually make out as well. So I think you have to look at it not so much how much you make on an hourly basis, on an annual basis, but I think a lot of people in these jobs actually have figured out that one of the great compensation components is securing their financial future at the end of their work career, to their pension. Do you agree with that? Three of you, especially, that had the long time tenure in service.
I totally agree. I certainly agree with it. I guess it depends on one's definition of what rich means. I think that our retirement package, which actually is, there is none like it. You know, be perfectly honest, once you get past 30 years, you have 75% of your base pay. And Dave and Holly will do even better because they changed the law and after I retired. you get another 2.5% no matter how long you serve. So you could actually end up with over more than 100%. And you add the medical benefit and what have you. The reality is these are things when we're younger we tend not to think of, but they are immense advantages to this kind of employment. In this day and age, when people are looking at their 401ks that are decrementing at 40% per year, this retirement is actually quite attractive. I would like to think that that's not the whole reason you're going to come into the public service sector, but it's certainly something you should look at, and it is, thank you for pointing it out, a huge plus, a very large pro.
I think that it is. I agree with that. Thanks to the essential genius of the framers when they created Article 3, I'm appointed for life, and that's wonderful. And it gives you security both in a financial way, but also in a decisional way. And that's what it was intended to do, of course. In Article 3. But that said, and I would be remiss if I didn't say this, I am among a small group of federal employees, federal judges, who didn't get a cost of living increase this year. We're the only ones. And in case you didn't know that, all other federal employees, including members of Congress, got a cost of living increase. Congress saw fit not to give even a small cost of living increase to federal judges. And as I said earlier, and this absolutely is not to cry poverty, because we're very fortunate, particularly in this day and age, and I want to make that clear. But when we have our clerks go out the door and make as much or more than what we're making, and law school deans making several times as much as we're making, one wonders sometimes. That said, I truly believe, and hearkening back to my remarks a few moments ago, if you don't want to do it, get out, do something else, and pursue another job or occupation. And if you sit in my case, in your chambers every day and you wallow in the thought that somebody else is doing better in the private sector, then you ought not be in these positions. We have to pay our public servants fairly. But we by no means should make them wealthy. That's not part of the bargain. And if you space it out in a non-lifetime appointment situation where there's a pension, I agree with the premise of your comments.
Yeah, just to make, I write a check every year for $460 and send it to TRICARE. That covers my wife and I almost everything. There's hardly any copay. So pretty good benefit. I'm not complaining.
I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on what sustains you in those moments when you make difficult decisions and you have to deal with the outrage of the public that you serve.
Well, I can address that from the distaff side, since my husband certainly was, I think, put on... had one of the more difficult grillings in front of Congress that there was. I think, again, you just have to examine your own behavior. If you feel that you made the best decision that you possibly could, that you're trying to carry out the mission that you were assigned and do it in the best manner possible, you know, you just have to, if you are satisfied with your own behavior, then I think you can move forward. It's always difficult when you have a nation full of armchair quarterbacks. I think the internet world has really contributed to that. Everybody's an expert. Everybody has an opinion. You cannot let that drive you. You have to trust your training, your experience, do what you feel is right, and move forward. I try not to speak for my husband, so I will say that that's my perception of the situation. But it can be very challenging when, I think, we were talking about Vietnam a while ago. I think when people truly confused the military who carry out our nation's policy with the people who create it and blame the military for the policy. I don't think we do that anymore. Largely, the attitude is much better toward the military, but sometimes there's some spillover, and you have to have a kind of thick hide sometimes and just hold fast to what you feel is right.
You haven't lived until you've had Ann Coulter devote a chapter of a book to you. And not in a good way, or Bill O'Reilly kick you around on national TV. And you do have to have a tough hide, depending on what you do and where you do it. But you do your best. And at the end of the day, imbued with that, it's not to say that the arrows don't sting when they hit, because they do, and we're all human, and we're all possessed of a certain sensitivity and ego that it's not particularly pleasant to be disemboweled by the punditry. In my case, going back to what we were just saying a moment ago, I have the wonderful benefit of the framers who allowed life appointments for federal judges and stopped us from being impeached and driven out of office for decisions that we make. But it's not quite that easy at other levels of the public service. And the great challenge for people, I think, and I know plenty of folks who are in elected office at all levels, is to occasionally make that tough decision that in its time may get them unelected or removed from office. There's been too little of that, I think, hopefully, if we are truly, as I said, in a revolutionary time, and I think that we are, we're going to see more public servants making difficult decisions that may cost them ultimately their office, but will be the right thing to you know, for them to do, and we'll get back to sort of the essence of what a democracy ought to be, and rather than having sort of an institutionalized ruling class.
I would agree with both of my colleagues here. It gets lonely at the top, very lonely, and you look to your left and you look to your right and you look behind, and you know, it's just you sitting there, and you have to have the strength of your convictions, the strength of your accumulated professional judgment over the many years that you've been at it, and to stand your ground. And I think, I guess it was Attorney General Comey that said, you know, at the end of the day, you do what's right. And I think that having an education at this institution or at the University of Maine, the grounding, that's not a very good word, but I call it balance, being grounded. These are very important things. What your parents taught you, all of those things, and you think of them when you're younger and you say, oh, what difference does that really make? It really does make it a time of the September of 07 when General Petraeus had to testify, or the decision that the judge had to make. Profoundly difficult times, very, very lonely times, and I think that at the end of the day, though, in both of these cases, the American people are ultimately very, very supportive, and the strength of their convictions, and there is no easy answer. for the question that you asked, and it is a reality when you get towards the phase of public life when you're looking through the rearview mirror, you're up there all alone, and you just have to have the strength of your convictions.
I think we have time for one more question.
I think long-term public servants understand the pros and cons of their chosen profession. They realize that it's not always fun, but it's almost always interesting and meaningful. They realize that there's a reasonable compensation, particularly when you think about the retirement benefit, like you mentioned over there. There are other non-monetary costs, though, too, particularly for military people. The separations from family, death, destruction, and wartime. So again, I think long-term public servants understand all that. But what I don't understand anyway, is how to inculcate in the American public how to the desire for public service, knowing those pros and cons. How do you do that? And I'd like you to think about that. We heard about a public service academy that I think is just a format for inculcation, not how to do it, not what the curriculum should be at that public service academy. I'd like to ask each of the panelists here, how would you do that? How would you inculcate that desire for public service, knowing the costs and the benefits? And don't just think about higher education, though. Think about lower education. I mean, you know, the secondary schools, how does that work in that way? Think about home, church, and somewhat at work, too. Thanks.
Well, I'll go ahead and start since I'm closest to you here, JR. I think some of it has to be by example. It's interesting, really, if you look at kids going in the military, how many of them are from military families? They basically grew up hearing and seeing that service lived, breathed, and presented as something important. And I think until that's done by society, more than it has been, it's not going to be a message that gets through. I was very pleased during the election campaign to hear both McCain and Obama come out strongly about ROTC needing to be on campuses as an option mm-hmm. for service. And I'll go farther on that. You know, college administrations send a message too. I know my son is a student at MIT. He's an ROTC cadet. They've had an ROTC battalion for a very long time. Harvard does not have one, so their students come over to MIT, as do Wellesley, Tufts, and a couple of other schools. But there are a lot of ROTC cadets at Harvard, and they do events there sometimes. And as far as I know, not once has the president of Harvard attended anything they've done. I don't believe even the commissioning. What kind of message does that send? So I would say, there's a responsibility in society and to walk the walk. If you're going to value this stuff, you got to show it. And it's got to be demonstrated that it's important and you think it's significant and a noble calling, really. It's not enough just to give a little bit of lip service to it. So all I can say is military kids grow up hearing it and seeing it. During World War II, there was a great national feeling that we need to work together. Our country needs to come together. I think there's an opportunity here to do that now. We have a lot of idealism out there. So it's important in all of us, really, to send a message to kids, not just college age, but younger, that serving your country is an important and noble thing to do.
Thank you, Holly. I would agree, and thanks for the question. A very good one. I believe the example is one wonderful, powerful way to convince the American people. And I think that in the military, we're very much encouraged to get out into our larger communities, wherever we might be stationed, and talk to the public, mix with them, explain to them what we do. Even in my retired life, I mean, there isn't a Lions Club or a Rotary Club or anybody that wants to listen, I'll go talk to them. And I try to challenge them that it's up to you. That's your job. You're the leadership elites of this little community or wherever it is you are, to convince the citizens of your town, to consent the guidance director at your high school. Is the guidance director at your high school one that allows recruiters access to the students, or is it one, like I find in the state of Maine and New England in general, they aren't always very conducive, to say nothing of our leading universities, the one that's in Cambridge, the one that's in New Haven. They do not have ROTC, and they at this point have no intention of doing so. There was a great op-ed by a young kid who's just graduating from Yale Law School this year, challenging, it was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, challenging our president to bring ROTC back. And he brought a bunch of kids up to West Point that he taught a citizen class, ship class to undergraduates during his third year in law school. And they had, of course, never seen people in uniform, never been on a military reservation in their life, and they were in awe of this. And so I think we have to continue to work in this area. And that didn't happen 40 years ago or 50 years ago when we were challenged by President Kennedy. We didn't have those kinds of challenges. And so we do have some work to do. And I think we have to be unrelenting in this work to make sure that we can explain our proposition to these youngsters who are coming out of our colleges and universities. And I think they're more than willing to serve. The other thing is that those who are against this idea or think that they have to somehow protect their undergraduates from, you know, these dastardly government officials asking them to serve in the public sector, in reality, I think what they're doing in the long term is counterproductive to what they're trying to protect themselves from. That forces those who come into these kinds of jobs to come from a smaller and smaller cross-section of society, which in a democracy I think is very harmful and something they, of all people, should be opposed to. The service that I came into as a 1968 under the great influence of General Hershey, I would submit to you, came from a much wider social and economic cross-section of society than our military comes from today. And so if you go to some, let's just pick a professor at Harvard or New Haven who's against this, what they're in reality doing in the long term is something that's counterproductive to what they're trying to protect themselves from. So we do have work to do, but I think we're making progress, and I think we're going to actually skip this generation, because this generation that's sitting here, these students, they're going to ignore this concern that maybe some of their faculty might have, and they are going to be, I think, a wonderful generation of public servants that's going to help our nation with the very, very vexing challenges we have here in the 21st century.
Just to put a capstone on it, and it's a great question, we can talk about the sort of grandiose designs of higher education, but you orient the question to a different level, and you should. And I think it starts in the home. And if you think of households across the country, and you think what we've become today, how many households across the country do we have where parents say to their kids, they're all bums, they're all thieves in public office, and we ought to throw them all out, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're all on the gravy train, every kind of trite phrase that you can say. And then, you know, you have the gospel according to, depending on your political perspective, Rush or Keith Olbermann, if you want to go to the other side, people one-stop shopping, 24-hour news cycle, the punditry that I think systematically dumbs down a lot of people who are otherwise not broadly thinking about things, and it's a witch's brew we should have a very healthy cynicism that's ingrained in America, in our public officials and our public servants, but I think it's much darker than that now. Why would you ever, if you grew up like that and you were bombarded with that cynicism, why would you ever choose public service? You'd have to have your head examined. I hope that as we embark now on what I've several times said is, you know, I think revolutionary age, we begin to think of the more noble ideals. And I think that needs to start with ratcheting down the cynicism that occurs in households where, you know, perhaps with some cause in some places, we've led our youth to believe that the entire political system is treading water and it is all corrupt and that you can't, in fact, make a difference and you shouldn't run for public office and you shouldn't seek positions that do the public good. I hope we're going to get away from that, but I think it has to start very early, and it has to start in the household before you get to wonderful institutions like we have here.
Please join me again in once again thanking our panelists. The final event in today's public service conference will be Summary and Next Steps, given by Baman Bakhtiari, Director of the School of Policy and International Affairs at the University of Maine, and H.L. Pullman, Executive Director of the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues here at Dickinson College. That event will be held at 4:30 p.m. right here in the Stern Center Great Room. Thank you. This concludes this event.